Hi, it's Dave. Welcome to a live stream. Today we have a special episode with former ARK analyst James Wang. He is currently doing a deep dive into crypto, all things crypto, and he's been on Twitter very active, really covering Ethereum, a lot of the different DeFi and a lot of different technologies out there. So I wanted to invite James on the show to kind of do an all things crypto episode and really, you know, get the lowdown on how we can understand this fast changing and really just amazing, interesting field. So welcome to the show, James.
Thank you, Dave. Love your show.
Yeah, awesome, man. So super excited. We've got this live stream going on. And the format is we'll do the first half of this show as more of a question answer. I've already gotten a bunch of questions from Twitter as well. And then the second half, we'll go ahead and dive into live questions. So if you have a question, go ahead, save it actually for the second half. And we're planning a 2-hour show here. So and then we'll, you know, have a bunch of time for questions as well. So first off, Ethereum, Bitcoin, the whole crypto market just seems like it's tanked the past couple of days. Lots of people are freaking out, saying, is this the beginning of the end? What's your take on all this price movement going on?
It's nothing. In crypto land, this kind of price movement, 5-8% on a given day, that's nothing. That's like the cloud passing over New York. It happens all the time. If you're worried about if this shakes you out, you should not be in crypto, because this will happen every couple of weeks or days sometimes. And when it really tanks, like we're talking 30-40% down in a single day. So if that doesn't sound like your cup of tea, stay in the S&P 500.
Yeah, that's a that's a great great line there. Like yeah, it seems like, you know, there are volatile stocks, but then it's nothing compared to the volatility of, you know, of crypto world. And I guess there is a sense where you got to get, you know, get used to it, get used to that.
You know, Netflix reported earnings a couple of days ago, and I think it was down like 8% after hours. And the headline was like Netflix crashes or tanks after, poor subscriber additions in the guidance. And I'm like, oh my God, it must be down like 20%. So I can check it, it's down 8%. I'm like, oh, so it's just like typical intraday move in crypto. This is like no news, move on.
I'm curious, in terms of your personal holdings, like what percent of your investments are in crypto assets versus, let's say, stocks or real estate or other forms of assets?
Sure, in the liquid component, and I tweeted this out a couple of months ago, it's 70% crypto, about 30% equities. There's some cash, but it's so small. It's like, I can't see it on the pie chart. So I am majority crypto right now.
Got it. And then what kind of keeps you, you know, long, let's say 70% over? I mean, is it your long-term conviction that this field is just in the early innings and early stages?
Yeah, I mean, any asset allocation is kind of like you're weighing the options available to you right now, right? So in terms of liquid allocation, buckets available to you, you have fixed income, which I think is not interesting to most of the listeners on this show. You have equities, which I hold, you know, a reasonable amount because I've been investing in equities for the last 10 years or so. But when allocating new capital, you kind of look at, and there's of course crypto. When you're allocating new crypto, new cash, you're trying to ask yourself which of these have the best risk and return profiles. And when I looked at, like, you know, a couple of months ago, it was at fixed income, I'm not going to touch. Equities is just like extremely expensive. Even if you believe in all the great narratives about tech, it is still very expensive. Part of the reason why software and tech has done so well over the last 5 years is because 5 years ago, if you're investing in that stuff, valuations were expensive for the time, but not crazy expensive. Like if you bought, say, Salesforce, you know, one of the great, like very stable growers in the last 10 years, you were paying 5 to 7 times revenues. Today, the multiples are higher. And across software, like SaaS companies, the multiples like 20-30x very easily. So when you are expensive to begin with, like for it to go up, it's just a lot more difficult. It's not saying it's not possible. Could you invest in tech names and still double your money in 5 years? Yes. Could you 5x your money? That's much harder. But the last 5 years, you like, well, of course, with the benefit of hindsight, you did and you could. So you have to kind of like look at where you are in terms of base rates and how much people are paying for it now. And then you look at crypto. Like one very simple kind of reason why I'm just comfortable with it is that let's just look at two very well-known names, Salesforce and Ethereum, right? Salesforce is roughly speaking a $200 billion company. Ethereum is a $200 billion protocol or cryptocurrency, if you will. Would you rather own Salesforce or Ethereum for the next 10 years? I would rather own Ethereum. That's just my personal take, right? Because it's like Salesforce is tens of thousands of people badgering you to subscribe to stuff and use software that you know Mark Benioff is literally kind of shoving down your throat at times. Great company, great product, and obviously you know added a lot of value to the world. But it's kind of a done story. Whereas you have Ethereum, which if you look at it, the addressable market is literally the entire financial system. And it is literally practically day one of Ethereum. Ethereum is not, Salesforce is a software product or a constellation of software products. Whereas Ethereum is a platform more akin to the internet. And stuff is built on top of it. Very few things are built on top of Salesforce. Yes, there are some app integrations and things like that, but generally you don't have an economy that is diverse and interesting on top of Salesforce. In Ethereum, there are entire companies, applications, economies being built on top. There are many analogies you can use, but one of the ones like kind of like Windows. You know, back in the day, you want to invest in Microsoft because so many applications are built on top of it. Ethereum is getting to the point now where it's not just this like cryptocurrency that you speculate on, but dozens upon dozens of useful applications are built on top of it and use it. And that's a very enviable position to be. Every tech company wants to be a platform, and Ethereum is already a platform. Mm-hmm.
What I mean, how do you value Ethereum like going forward? Like you're saying, okay. You know, holding, you know, Salesforce versus Ethereum 10 years down the road, I could at least map out potential Salesforce revenue, profits, multiple, et cetera, to get a valuation. How are you valuing Ethereum 5 or 10 years out? Is there a metric, a framework that you use?
Sure. It's like, without getting too smart, you can just kind of look at the TAMs, right? Salesforce is effectively billing itself after sales and marketing teams and the kind of business operations teams. It's strictly a piece of kind of the spend of a company. And it's one vertical, right? It's, you know, they've expanded a bit, but substantially it's one vertical. Whereas Ethereum's TAM is open-ended. There's, in a way, you can't value it because what it can do is completely open-ended. In the last, in 2017, we weren't sure what Ethereum was able to do. We only had this idea that, you know, this could be a new kind of computer for the internet, a new platform for the internet. But we had no idea. So all kinds of ICOs, initial coin offerings came out, and we had stuff from Dentacoin and weird things that didn't make any sense. Over the last 2 years or so, two use cases actually have emerged for Ethereum. One is this thing called decentralized finance, or what people call DeFi. Basically using Ethereum to do things that banks used to do, borrowing, lending, and, you know, things like that. The other one is NFTs, non-fungible tokens, where essentially any artist now has a piece of magical software that allows them to mint unique and scarce digital assets. We could never create scarce digital assets prior to, practically speaking, Ethereum's kind of NFT technology. So now we have these two things. If you try to value Ethereum 3 years ago, you couldn't have come up with any of these because you wouldn't have known ahead of time that they were going to be invented. So narrowly speaking, you could value Ethereum's opportunity in terms of the scale of the financial system if you just look at DeFi. And that's roughly speaking about $3 trillion a year. That's the amount the global banking and auditing system generates per year, about $3 trillion. Arthur Hayes did this amazing analysis on his blog. Everyone who's interested should read that. I think it's the best single piece of kind of top to bottom kind of thesis for Ethereum with a framework for valuation, and you can read it in 15 minutes. Arthur Hayes, we can link to it. But yeah, like basically it's like if you just want to take a conservative view, take the global financial system and the banking system and the auditing system, $3 trillion in revenue a year. If Ethereum captures 0.1% of that revenue, it would be worth about $4,000 a token. If it captures 1%, it would be worth $40,000 per Ethereum, per Ether. And that's a 20x from where we are today. So like that's very clear. And that's only one use case, right? And because it's a platform, it can, like, 6 months from now, we could be talking about some entire new case we couldn't have imagined and estimated right now.
Mm. I mean, those estimations of how much it could be valued, let's say 0.1% or 1%, I mean, how is that? I mean, are you using, for example, okay, eventually the platform can take a cut, a revenue. And so perhaps there could be future cash flows and therefore, you know, we could have a valuation on Ethereum, or are you just taking it more as like, hey, this could be a store of value that people adopt, and through the adoption, right, the value of Ethereum increases. What's your kind of approach to that?
It's the first one. It's basically Ethereum captures fees for using it. Mm-hmm. I think it's helpful to maybe just walk through kind of what Ethereum is, right? I think it's still a very vague concept for a lot of people. Like maybe to contrast it with Bitcoin. Bitcoin's main value proposition is that it's a scarce digital asset, and it's now emerged. It's only 21 million Bitcoin that will ever be generated, and because of that, it's scarce. And if enough people believe and it has value, then it has this forms this belief network, and effectively, people use it as a reliable and neutral store of value. That's kind of the Bitcoin value proposition, but it doesn't do anything really else beyond that, and it doesn't want to. It just wants to solve the money use case or the store of value use case in a digital format. You can't really write an application to Ethereum, right? There's nothing for you to do. That's part of the reason why when you join one of these like Bitcoin Clubhouse or Bitcoin Twitter, the only thing they will ever talk about is the price, because there is nothing else to talk about. You join Ethereum Twitter or Ethereum Clubhouse, and it is just an endless deluge of kind of technological development and software releases. Ethereum is software. I mean, Bitcoin is software too, but it's software that has no roadmap, or the roadmap is very done, basically. The Bitcoin people think that the less roadmap, the better, because then you can't screw it up. With Ethereum, it's an extremely rich roadmap. It's like going to the AWS reInvent conference. It's like, okay, the year is 2021. What new features are we going to ship this year? What new features are we going to ship next year? How are we going to improve the user experience for wallets, for storage, for insurance? It's like it's viewed as the same way as a software company would manage their product roadmap. So it's this constantly evolving piece of software. And because of that, stuff is built on top of Ethereum. You can be a software developer on Ethereum. Being a software developer on Bitcoin has very thin meaning. It basically means like, oh, we can maybe support it in the wallet. You can't, there's nothing you can do. And the reason why Ethereum can do this is because Ethereum is a network of computers it's a network of computers that elect to run the Ethereum software to validate transactions. And the way you deploy applications to the Ethereum computer is by targeting this runtime called the Ethereum virtual machine. Java has a virtual machine. Ethereum has a virtual machine. You see the parallels very clearly. And you write applications to it. And this virtual machine runs on top of actual hardware. It could be x86, could be ARM. And these are about 10,000 computers distributed in the world. So people treat it like a computer system that they run, just like they treat AWS as a cloud that they can deploy applications to. So when people think about, like, I find that people who don't like Bitcoin because they find it to be a little bit of a more about a religion around a digital rock and constantly fighting this belief system, it's very political. That when that doesn't resonate with them, I find that it resonates better when you talk about Ethereum as, don't worry about this cryptocurrency nonsense, it's just software. Okay, and you can write applications to it. And you know what? If you're a software developer, you can, and you know JavaScript, the language for Ethereum, which is called Solidity, is very similar. You can deploy an application in a weekend. And once they can see that, you don't have to argue about supply and tokenomics and all that stuff. You just treat it as kind of a place where you can deploy useful applications. And I think that's the right way to view it as software. That gets rid of all the unhealthy debate about prices and you know, your blockchain versus my blockchain, it's just software. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed there's this dichotomy, it feels like, in the crypto world, where you have a certain camp that really focuses more on the belief, right? The belief and adoption create the value, right? And then you have another camp where it's more on the utility and the usage, like it has to, you know, create some unique value, and that value gives the blockchain or currency, whatever, right, its value. And it seems like there is this dichotomy where, you know, you have certain Bitcoiners who are in this, who cares about the tech? It's about all about the belief, right? And and there seems to be kind of a religious bent, you know, with this a bit, where it's like, you know, Satoshi is, you know, higher level being, and, you know, like Bitcoin can never be improved on, and this is the final, like, end, you know, state of whatever. And it feels like, you know, you're taking this other camp. You're saying, hey, you know, that's like, that's not what it's all about. It's about software. It's about utility, right? Do you pick this up? You know, this dichotomy in like the crypto world, and like,
it's very rooted in human psychology. Like, humans really want to believe in stuff, and once, like, there's a certain subset of humans I think that have the temperament of, I must pick a system to believe in, and that fulfills a bunch of functions for their like livelihood. Like, you belong in a church for various reasons, right? You need to solve the problem of the meaning of life. You kind of solve the meaning. You solve the problem for how do I find community. You solve for belonging. You solve for loneliness. Like, there's a bunch of reasons you solve for, and it's kind of like classic religions are the kind of this bundled solution to that. And that instinct is very deep in our genes. And it manifests over time throughout history, just in different ways. So in the same way as someone would be very kind of, someone who is would be very religious in the Middle Ages, if you take the same person, you put them, you make them born today, they find new things that they can be kind of religious and attach themselves to. And like the same person literally born today would probably be really into Bitcoin. Right. And that temperament is leans toward more attachment to beliefs rather than modification to beliefs. And then there are other people in the world who, on preferential scales like Myers-Briggs or Big Five, this like openness to new experience. And they tend to just be more open in thinking. That's what these people would tend to self-select to systems that are changing. So it's like, if you zoom out a bit, it has more to do with human temperament preferences rather than underlying realities. There is going to be a subset of people who have strong genetic inclination to attachment to belief systems. And Bitcoin is perfect for them. Christianity would be perfect for them in the first century, right? But right now, it's like, this is perfect. You have a mysterious figure. You don't have a lot of literature. You have one piece of original literature, the Old Testament, that's called the Bitcoin White Paper. Like, it's exactly the same thing. I'm going to prescribe to this, and I'm not going to change. And then, of course, you like just like Christianity kind of broke off into various sects over the last two millennia. Now you have Bitcoin Cash. You have Bitcoin Satoshi Vision. You have different levels of like purity in the religion. It's exactly the same thing. If you zoom out a bit, there's like nothing new under the sun. Mm.
Do you think Ethereum has a chance to beat out Bitcoin as a store of value? Do you think it can become a larger market cap, say, coin in the future?
Yes, I think so. The reason is, like, to think that Bitcoin is the final word in what blockchains can do is kind of ridiculous, because it's the first invention. You never have a situation where the first invention is literally the best and the final. That would be like saying, you know, the IBM mainframe when it was invented, and someone would be, imagine a group of people saying, this is the last computer we'll ever need. This is the only true computer. All subsequent computers are shit computers or fake computers, you know, and then like that's ridiculous. We know that's just not how things work. Also, Bitcoin is an application-specific technology, so it solves one use case. It solves for money and nothing else. And insofar as there are other use cases, these other chains will try to fulfill those use cases, right? So Ethereum is a generalized solution. Basically, you can use it for a variety of applications, and that TAM has to be definitionally larger than the one simply for money. So one way to think of it is, Bitcoin kind of is the digital equivalent of gold. Whereas Ethereum is kind of like addresses the entire financial system. In the financial system, gold is just a subset of things that you trade on the stock exchange, right? Gold is just a subset of money. So it's almost definitionally smaller than the TAM of Ethereum. And Right now, I think Bitcoin is bigger just because it's had longer time to tell its narrative, to convince buyers. It has bigger mind share than Ethereum, mm-hmm. but it has more TAM than Ethereum. Yeah. So like institutional buyers have been hammered finally to like maybe accept Bitcoin as something they should consider in their portfolio after a decade. But the Ethereum story, people are still afraid to say the word on CNBC. So it's just earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like Ethereum is like, you know, when smart contracts first came out, it was like a great idea, but to figure out exactly what to do with it, it was a challenge. But in the past couple of years, especially with DeFi and other uses, it's like, oh, okay, there's some product market fit, and the story is just getting started with Ethereum. I'm curious, if Ethereum is able to flip Bitcoin in terms of market cap in the future, who knows how long that will be, if it's a few years or several years or whatever, what's the point of Bitcoin then? Like, can Ethereum be that store value, that digital gold, in addition to this, let's say, alternative crypto economy universe, right?
Yeah. I don't think it's a zero-sum game. I think people, like, the reason why we have such diverse numbers of everything is because people have such diverse beliefs and value systems. I think Bitcoin serves a perfectly good role as the most secure, the most, like, Lindy and like, censorship resistant digital store of value. I think if you just rank it on store of value security, Bitcoin is still the most secure because it requires more computation to verify. And Ethereum is going to switch over to a new kind of blockchain system called store proof of stake. And I think many people would argue that is not as secure as Bitcoin's proof of work algorithm. So, like, just like gold has a role in the current modern financial system, even though we're no longer, you know, in Florentine times, even though we have Venmo and all this digital stuff, gold is still a thing. And then we came up with GLD, an ETF to trade this stuff. Like, it has anything that's had 1,000, 2,000 years of history has a place, and people recognize it for what it is. I think Bitcoin will always be kind of the original, and people respect it. And it could be the ultimate, like, the safest way to store value when Ethereum and these other chains, because of the fact that they have a software roadmap, they have the potential to introduce bugs. They have the potential for mismanagement, for misgovernance. There will always be, I think, a need for something that is, call it permanent, immutable and ossified, which is kind of, these are words that don't sound good, but these are words that, like, for Bitcoin community are positive features and people want it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one way to look at kind of Bitcoin actually is, I think, in the bigger picture of the entire kind of crypto, kind of alternative, this economic crypto system, where Bitcoin can be kind of like the easiest on-ramp, the easiest exchange to get into that system, perhaps, you know, the most popular at this moment. And, but there is something much bigger than Bitcoin, you know, where if you look beyond just the Bitcoin conversations and you look to what's happening on Ethereum and other blockchains, there's a lot of innovation happening. There's a lot of companies, you know, creating stuff and people adopting stuff. And you mentioned the whole thing about lending and borrowing, right? With, let's say, Compound and Aave and others. Like, what other kind of big use cases have you seen on Ethereum? You mentioned NFTs as, you know, another big one. So are those kind of the two big ones recently that you've seen on Ethereum, which is the lending, borrowing, kind of earning interest, and then number two, NFTs? Are there any others? And if those are the two, like, what about those two use cases are exciting to you?
Sure. I just put out a newsletter on kind of five actually useful things that blockchains can do in 2021. Like, these are things I think normal people would be interested in, not just like people in crypto. You ask someone in crypto what, like, oh, hey, can Ethereum do anything? They'll be like, yeah, you can mine for liquidity on automated market maker. And you're like, what? What does that mean, and why would I be interested? They think very funny. So I picked out things that, like, normal people would be interested in, and you can check out the newsletter. But I think of the things we talked about, lending is by far the most no-brainer activity you can do, because just the number of people who have a bank account is in the, you know, billions, and the number of people who would be interested in earning a above inflation rate return on just your savings is everyone on Earth. So you could argue that's a TAM of 7.5 billion people right there. And Ethereum would do that for you today, right? So if you have $1,000 and you want to earn some interest, if that's lingering in your bank account, that's earning less than 0.5% interest. You can shoot that $1,000 to Coinbase and convert it to a stable coin, so like USDC. These stable coins are not speculation instruments. They're pegged to the US dollar. So one for one, you turn into $1,000 USDC. And then you deposit it into one of these crypto lending platforms. This is just software again, right? This could be Aave, this could be Compound, this could be Yearn, dozens of options for you. And roughly speaking, it will earn you like 10, 15% APY on that immediately. A couple of things different about how this is versus like a CD or a term deposit bank. A, there's no term, so you can deposit it anytime, you can withdraw it anytime. There's no like limit. Like if you do a CD and you do it, you withdraw early, there are nasty penalties and all kinds of nonsense with that. The second one is it's a variable interest rate, call it, you know, account. So one day it could be 10%, the other day it could be 12%. It fluctuates based on the market demand for this specific stablecoin you're depositing. And the third is to use these pieces of software, these crypto lending protocols. Like if you've ever used any traditional finance software or app, the sign up process, the onboarding is like the most torturous part, right? It's like provide your name, your social security number. I don't know, can you even open a bank account online? Like maybe go to your branch. It's just like the most onerous thing because financial products have the most onerous regulation. On these crypto lending and borrowing platforms, you can get everything done without so much as even supplying an email address. No social security, no driver's license, not even an email address. You literally plug in your wallet address. You literally have a wallet, kind of like MetaMask, that's in your browser as a plugin, and you click lend, and then it syncs with your wallet, and then it happens, like, and you can get this done in like 5 minutes. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recently had a couple months ago, I had Robert Leschner from Compound on, and he kind of, you know, was detailing the whole borrowing lending on DeFi as kind of one of these killer use cases. It seems though it's still a little bit challenging to do kind of simple lending. Like you have to do a bunch of steps, and even to monitor. I mean, it feels like it's like the first generation, like the first, you know, hey, we proved that there is a, you know, a killer use case. The UI and the experience will still have to be hashed out and for the next generation and stuff. But it seems like, you know, that was one of the big breakthroughs of the past, let's say, year or two, was, hey, there is this killer use case of lending, getting interest rates. Why can't this happen on Bitcoin? Some Bitcoiners would say, hey, we've got BlockFi, we've got all this other stuff, you know, there's no difference.
It can't happen on Bitcoin because Bitcoin's blockchain is not fully programmable. It's a very script, a very limited programming model, and it's not designed for this. It's designed to be immutable, right? It's not designed to support a whole software stack on top. It was like the spec is just to store value and to use as cash. So Bitcoin by the Bitcoin blockchain by itself is not designed to do this. There are efforts to kind of build around it to enable this in some other way. There's a kind of project being done called Stacks right now that's basically kind of like a side chain to Bitcoin. It has its own security model and its own kind of nodes to verify. But basically, you can kind of use that as a mechanism to run smart contracts adjacent and settled on the Bitcoin blockchain. So that's one project that's interesting. Another one is one that just launched recently on mainnet called Rune or Thorchain. So the idea between Thorchain is it's kind of like a more universal version of Uniswap. Uniswap is a protocol that is probably the most popular application right now on Ethereum. It's basically a decentralized exchange. So imagine right now if you want to buy some kind of crypto token, you go to Coinbase. And Coinbase is a company with an address that, you know, building in New York, and it's under complete regulatory oversight of the US government as well as foreign governments, right? So it's very ironic that although Bitcoin is a decentralized and censorship-resistant currency, the main points of transmission are these centralized exchanges that are nevertheless completely under the purview of government. So it's like, are you really decentralized if the most critical checkpoints, it's like, oh, we have these highways that are completely, you know, libertarian and free. But then there are these checkpoints everywhere, and they're the government, the oversight, centralized exchanges. So why can't you have an exchange where The exchange itself is decentralized, and you can swap between, say, you know, a token like the Maker and Ethereum. Like, why can't I do that? That's what Uniswap kind of achieved 2 to 3 years ago. It's basically it's a super simple interface, two drop downs. You plug in what you have. Maybe you have Ether, maybe you have Uniswap, maybe you have Maker, and then you plug in what you want. It's like, I want USDC, I want, you know, Chainlink, like arbitrary. It's a simple platform to arbitrarily swap from one token to another. The problem with Uniswap is it's an Ethereum application. It will only work with Ethereum-based tokens. So you can swap between Chainlink and Maker or USDC or DAI, but you cannot swap between any Ethereum token and some other blockchain's token. You cannot swap Ethereum for Bitcoin. You cannot swap Litecoin for, you know, Solana. Those are not supported. So the kind of, given the success of Uniswap, the desire is to build a universal decentralized exchange that will let you exchange tokens from any blockchain to another blockchain. That's the dream. And various proposals have been kind of developed to do this over the years, and none have really succeeded in the correct way, which is, you know, fully decentralized, no wrapped tokens and things like that, until ThorChain, which launched basically this month. And with ThorChain, the big killer use case, or one of the killer use cases, is that it connects to the Bitcoin blockchain. So for the first time, if you imagine every blockchain as these kind of like separate nations or separate internets, obviously you want to establish trade routes and you want to connect them together, right? We don't want isolated islands. We want them to be connected together. So ThorChain is the first time that you can do kind of exchange-based swappage without wrapping tokens between the Bitcoin blockchain and the Ethereum blockchain, as well as the other elder ones being added.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can people try out ThorChain right now, or is it kind of like really hard right now to do?
They can try it out. I haven't tried it out personally, okay, but the protocol is live and millions of dollars are being exchanged on it, but it's literally the first release. So think of it as like using Facebook version 0.5 beta. So don't put serious money in it. Just like, it's early. One of the kind of, if you think Facebook's motto of, you know, move fast and break things is funny, and you know, the users are the victim. Yeah. Crypto is another level. It's like the motto is, we test in production. So
sure.
Use with caution.
Yeah. Probably with a lot of stuff, most stuff in the crypto world, use with caution. What's the role of Coinbase then going forward? I mean, if the dream is to have this completely decentralized, let's say, exchange, you could do any asset to any asset, then, you know, Coinbase is, you know, making a fortune off of being that middleman, right? Letting you exchange the Bitcoin for Ethereum, Ethereum for Cardano, the Cardano for whatever. Does Coinbase need to just evolve and, you know, provide ancillary financial services, lending, borrowing, make it more like a easier kind of, I don't know, maybe mom and pop, grandma, grandpa type of like super easy experience? Or will Coinbase ultimately, you think, be disrupted by the decentralized stream itself?
Like, Coinbase fulfills a very crucial function that no decentralized DEX can do right now, which is fiat on-ramp. So the first step in crypto is to convert your normal dollars into crypto dollars. And only centralized exchanges can really do that today. So step one has to go through things like Coinbase. And that's kind of an important step. Long-term, I think they'll find that yes, we are very early and there will be consolidation. There will be the rates of the brokerage rates will basically come down over time. It's going to follow exactly the history of kind of the stock market. You know, back in the 90s or 2000s, if you want to trade a stock, you have to pick up your phone, call your broker. It's $50. It's like this very big process, right? And today it's online. It's Robinhood. It's free, commission-free trading. So it went to zero over, you know, 20 years or so. Right now we're like the 90s for stocks, but for crypto, the take rates for buying crypto is 0.3%. That's a lot. Like that's imagine if you buy stocks, it charges you 0.3% on your total sum. That is a lot, and that's the current kind of, you know, Uniswap rate. But the competition is very intense. SushiSwap, PancakeSwap, you know, centralized exchanges. So that will come down. I think there will be no money in the long term to be made in just kind of like swapping tokens. So you have to basically do value added services. And I think Coinbase brilliant team. In the end, they'll probably switch out their kind of back end to just use decentralized exchanges. They don't even have to worry about that anymore, and just like worry, like do value added services like staking and custody and things like that for customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, in some ways, you know, like Coinbase can be a bridge, you know, from that decentralized world to the more of this, as you're saying, this on-ramp to, let's say, not just fiat, but let's say there's other services and things to interact with the traditional finance world, or just, I don't know, there's a million and one, like, you know, ways to, it does not, in a way, I think, have to be a complete either or. I think there can be some mix of decentralized and centralized coexisting in the future. Yeah, but I mean, overall though, I mean, the thing that gets me excited about DeFi in crypto is that is the total addressable market is not just gold. Like that's kind of a lot of times the Bitcoin story, right? Hey, we're digital gold, the addressable market is $9 trillion. It's like, but when you look at what Ethereum and some of these other blockchains are doing, the addressable market really is a different game. It's not gold, it's the entire financial market and building an entire like ecosystem of, I kind of look at it as this parallel universe, you know, that's being built, completely decentralized on crypto, and it's mind-boggling in a sense. To me, it's a much bigger vision and a much bigger endeavor than just trying to take out gold. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely, and it's a positive sum vision. Like, I think it's really lame to have a business vision which is there is an existing market that's $10 trillion. And we just want to take that. Those are not big ideas, in my opinion. No disrespect, but that's just like literally taking what already exists. It's way more interesting to create new markets. The market for Ethereum, narrowly speaking, for DeFi, the DeFi use case only is the financial services segment of the economy, $3 trillion in revenue a year. That's one vertical on Ethereum. Ethereum is not just one vertical. We found two so far of meaning, right? DeFi and NFTs. NFTs, you could market in terms of fine art. You could size it in terms of gaming. That's another couple of $100 billion right there. But what else is coming? Like, just imagine kind of blank dashed lines on top of the Ethereum stack. We don't know what is coming. So its TAM is open-ended, whereas Bitcoin's TAM is constrained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting too. It's like some of this stuff is still yet to be solved, you know, like exactly like whether it's, you know, putting insurance or various, you know, other types of, you know, anything relational that requires, you know, transactions. If you could take out all of the inefficiencies, stick it in some type of programmable format, you've got an immense amount of savings there that could be scaled, and that equals billions, if not trillions of dollars. It's crazy. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm kind of, when I'm listening to you here, because like, I know you've been with ARK Invest for many years as their, mostly, were you doing more, I know you were doing kind of hardware, right? Were you doing other areas in terms of like software or AI at all in terms of analysis?
I focused on AI as the research topic. Okay. And it kind of flowed down to a couple of things underneath. One is semiconductors and chips like NVIDIA. The other is software and neural net algorithms and Google and things like that. And I covered, toward the tail end, I covered the general enterprise software or SaaS segment, which was kind of, I think, the biggest booming sector in the last, you know, 5 years in software. So, yeah. And in the beginning, I covered consumer net. So most, like, general tech, I kind of mm-hmm. covered at different points in time with ARK. But the focus from a research perspective was on AI.
Yeah, because I noticed, like, you know, ARK was early with Bitcoin. And, you know, they nailed that along with Tesla and Square. And, you know, their research is absolutely top-notch and fantastic. Everyone I talk with, you know, from ARK has just been blowing me away. But it does seem a little bit like, in terms of DeFi and Ethereum, this whole other, you know, as you're talking about, this total addressable market in the trillions of, you know, how, let's say, you know, it could be completely disrupted, is something that it's not completely latched onto in ARK's research or their reports. Is there any, like, I mean, I don't want you to, obviously, I know you just came out from ARK and we both respect ARK a lot, but is there any background to that? Is it just something that's a process where, you know, as a research explorer, they'll, you know, I don't know if you have any insight. If you don't want to share, that's fine too. I just want curious.
I don't know why. I'm not sure. You should ask Yassine. I mean, he's the one covering it. I know you've had him on.
I have. Maybe I should have Yassine on again. And
be my research, bro.
Yeah, maybe I'll have him on with you together. I think it's interesting stuff. I want to ask you about Tesla AI because. This is a little bit different than crypto, but so the format for those who are just joining our live stream is we're doing the first hour just kind of chatting about all things crypto, and I want to talk about Tesla a bit too. But the second hour is going to be an open question answer from our viewers, and so if you have a question, save it for the second hour. I know James, you've been you worked at NVIDIA, you understand the chip side, you've analyzed Tesla's hardware, et cetera. We know that Tesla has their so-called hardware 3 in their cars. They're probably working on hardware 4. Now they've been working on this Tesla Dojo supercomputer neural net training computer for the past year or two, and they're prepping for a possible Tesla AI. Like, what's your take on kind of Tesla Dojo? Like, is it really needed? I mean, do they really have to create their own neural net training supercomputer? Couldn't they use some other solution? And what are the implications for Tesla creating their own supercomputer? Are there other, can they use it as a kind of AWS neural net training as a service? Or what's the kind of potential going forward with that?
Yeah, I was surprised when they talked about building their own training hardware. Because as you say, it's training hardware is a lot more complex to design than inference hardware. Inference hardware is the hardware you use to run the neural network. Training hardware is the hardware you use to create the neural network in the first place. The big difference is during the training hardware, you have to feed it a lot of data, and the training happens in the data center. Whereas inference is you've already got the software, you just deploy it on deploying your app on the iPhone. You just run it in the local environment, in which case the FSD computer in the car. So if you look at AI chip startups, there are way more startups doing inference hardware than training, because training is just a lot more complicated. So when I saw the announcement came out, I was like, why do you need to do this? And I think it comes down to the fact that they have a very specific AI problem, and they have they have the largest quantity of video training data in the world, and I think for a specific application, driving, I think the only other one you would compare to is something like YouTube. For this application of driving, they have more content, they have more data than every car manufacturer included, times probably 1,000, right? It's orders and orders of magnitude more. And if they were to use off-the-shelf hardware, if they were to order a computer from NVIDIA, say, like build together a cluster of NVIDIA DGX servers, I think it would cost them probably on the order of maybe $100 million or close to that, right? It would be probably in that range. And the cost for them to build this in-house, given they already have a team for building FSD, is probably on the order of tens of millions of dollars. But that's not even the point. I'm sure it's not about saving $50 million, because Tesla's CapEx is in the billions. I think it's more about achieving what's not really plausible using off-the-shelf solutions. NVIDIA's hardware is designed to deal with all kinds of neural networks, language, speech, video, pure reinforcement learning. It's designed to solve, their strategy is to launch one chip architecture for every industry vertical and then address the verticals using software. Tesla is a vertical use case, a single use case problem, right? We just want to solve driving. So I think their motivation is basically saying, we have this very specific use case. We have an abnormal amount of data that the current kind of computers and supercomputers out there are not even designed to kind of optimally handle. You would need a lot of them to sort of fit it in. So, and we already have a generation of experience building our own kind of chips using our internal team. So they have, think of it this way. Andrei Karpathy has a very specific set of software requirements. He can basically list in 10 bullets, if you can give me a computer with X, how much teraflops, how much memory, what kind of interconnect, and what kind of neural network architecture support, I would be able to train at what rate. And if you plug in that kind of requirement spec into what's available off the shelf or Amazon, it probably costs an absurd amount of money. Whereas if he kind of looks across the cubicle at the hardware team and say, hey, can you build that for me, Pete, or whoever's running the show right now? That person will be like, yes, we can build a five nanometer chip of this kind of size. We can build a custom interconnect that's perfect for your video. Well, in fact, like, we can size the buffers to match the size of the video buffers and build a super optimized chip for that and attach storage really and memory really close to the chip. And, you know, we could probably ship it by the end of, call it this year. And that would allow them to basically kind of leapfrog any competition. Not that they have any real competition, but it would allow them to essentially take all the data they have, which right now is too large to plausibly fit in the training hardware you can buy off the shelf, but actually make it fit in this custom computer they build. And if they can make it fit, they can train the perfect neural network that would actually solve self-driving. And you optimize that, shrink it, ship it in FSD in the inference phase. So
what's the feature of this? So Tesla makes their own internal, you know, neural net training, you know, clusters. It's great. It works well for them. So it seems like there's a couple of paths here. One path is, so fine, it's an internal, you know, neural net training computer. Fine. Who cares? You know, Tesla does. And the results and the benefits are purely full self-driving, right? It impacts that. Another route to go about it is saying, hey, can they use this stuff that they've learned and that they've built, right, to do something else with? Can they, you know, are there other business lines, you know, can they open it up as, you know, a service? Is there any potential for that even, you know, is that even like, you know, some revenue that's significant or not? I mean, what's your take on what is the kind of the significance of the, you know, the potential of them building their own training hardware?
I mean, it's easy to like, kind of go down the road of, oh, you have a chip, now you can kind of build an AWS or diversify your business. I don't think that's how it works at all for this kind of thing. The whole point of vertical, like your first business decision, your first strategy decision you make as a business is, are you a horizontal business or a vertical business? Your horizontal business, you build a component like NVIDIA and you try to sell it to as many people as possible. If you're a vertical kind of business model like Apple, you build a very specialized thing for yourself and you keep it damn well to yourself and you don't give anyone. And if anyone even builds something that even looks like it, you sue the hell out of them, right? So you have to, those are the only two business models that make sense. Anything in the middle just kind of like is doesn't make sense. It's very confused and it's not optimized for anything. Tesla is pursuing the vertical strategy. Even if they shouldn't have the desire to share this with anyone because it just literally just throwing away your competitive advantage in the wind. And it's not like this is part of the mission of accelerating sustainable energy. This is not battery technology where it's good for the environment if you share it. This is proprietary software technology that, you know, will help you differentiate against everyone else doing it. So it's not part of that open ethos. And secondly, horizontal business models have entirely different requirements and operating kind of realities than vertical business models. If you want to sell this chip as a service, now you have to build out a whole team that is about supporting your customers' use cases. So let's say Tesla is like, okay, we're a all, you know, image-based sensor array. We have no LiDAR, and this is why we built the chip this way. You try to sell it to someone that's using LiDAR, they'll be like, oh, can you add support for a LiDAR image map? Can you add support for this buffer, that buffer? Soon you're just like, you need a whole team to kind of service customers. That's not what Tesla does. Tesla does not service the needs of VW and GM. You know, they're in the business of serving their own teams first and foremost. So just look it through the lens of Apple. You know, I wrote a blog on this, kind of Tesla through the lens of Apple. The strategy is exactly the same. They're going to make their own things the absolute best first and foremost. And that's their kind of lever of differentiations against competitors. They neither have the desire, nor does it make any business sense to make it horizontal because it just it slows them down and it makes no significant revenue.
Mm-hmm. Elon Musk was saying that, you know, he thinks that Tesla can become one of the largest AI companies in the world, at least like shallow-minded AI, you know, not deep-minded like Google. But and then you've got this whole Tesla AI Day coming up. And if you look at historically their events with Autonomy Day and Battery Day, they have been very significant, like strategy events, 5 or 10 year foundational events that you know, that they've hosted. For a Tesla AI Day, you know, like, you know, one angle you could say, hey, they'll just showcase some of the stuff they're working on, autonomy or whatever, you know, that narrow case. But my question is, like, does that really deserve a whole Tesla AI day? And then it's also in light of Elon's recent comments that they could possibly become one of the largest AI companies. So is there something else you think that Tesla can showcase or really, you know, make Tesla AI day about? And then the other angle is like Elon saying, hey, we tried to solve autonomy, but on the way, along the way, we've had to solve a lot of real world AI problems. I say physical world, navigation, all this stuff in the busy, you know, world of humans and bikes and kids and pedestrians, all this stuff. And so there's a lot of expertise built up with that, that is not just for, I mean, you're trying to solve autonomy, but you've built up all this extra kind of real world, you know, solutions and expertise. Like, where is this headed? Do you see potential for Tesla to get into other real world AI applications like robots, like drones, like I don't know what else, but kind of what's your take on all this?
That's interesting. I wasn't aware AI Day is coming. That's very interesting. The last time they did, I think it was a battery day and they showcased some advances there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Elon said, I think it was late July is his expectation of Tesla AI Day. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think probably the most obvious thing they need to show is material progress on FSD, right? Because, you know, they've been in beta and trialing this out. They've made promises that they've broken over and over again. So I think they need to show a demo that's far more compelling than the Palo Alto demo they did, you know, a few years ago. So I think something on the order of complexity of you know, busy streets, San Francisco, they need to show a kind of like jaw-dropping demo to kind of put some of this criticism and skepticism from the press behind them. I think they may talk about certainly Dojo and the kind of the infrastructure side of how they're going to differentiate and the mechanisms of training on large scale video data, which is no one is doing. So those are probably nuts and bolts. But if you were to speculate on future places they could go, I think what's interesting is OpenAI has provided a perspective on what kind of business you can build with really large scale models. So OpenAI started off as a research organization for AI, kind of like the DeepMind of the US, but evolved to a commercial company. And their kind of first product is a product called GPT-3, and it is a generative language model, basically a neural network that can write, call it English. And it's very generalized in the sense that it not only writes English, it can write poetry, it can write, translate between languages, it can write JavaScript, right? So because it was trained on the entire corpus of text on the internet. So it's read every Stack Overflow, it's read every, you know, programming manual, it can actually output code. So when you train across an extremely large data set, you can basically learn all the sub kind of use cases expressed in that data set. What Tesla potentially could build with its video data set is a generalized computer vision data set. So if the result of kind of Dojo and all this data is that it can, with very little human labeling, build a neural network that has robust understanding of images and video, I think that would be, you could think of that as a GPT-3 equivalent, but for video. And that could perhaps be deployed in all kinds of adjacent industries. It could be deployed in, you know, surveillance, security, robotics. There are many, many applications. So that could become conceivably a software kind of a SaaS product or like an API that they could offer to developers that could just generate pure software revenue. Mm-hmm.
I want to actually ask you about this. This is interesting because that's kind of one of the ideas I was thinking about too. It's like, okay, so if you are solving kind of real world AI where you actually have to, with vision, have to identify every single object, but not just every single object, you have to identify its velocity or how fast it's moving, its distance from you and from others, and make predictions on where things are going as well. You're solving all of these problems, right, with understanding, you know, real world AI, actually maybe creating like a 3D type of, you know, understanding of what's going on. Then that this type of expertise in real world can possibly apply to many other, you know, scenarios or use cases. I mean, one angle is like, oh, Tesla could possibly go into robots, physical robots or drones, where it needs that type of real world understanding, right? Another angle is, hey, maybe they can open it up as a web service or API or something, right? Where, hey, if Tesla has like this massive, not just data set, but, you know, this neural net and vision platform where they can identify not just objects, but again, it's like everything going around in that, you know, environment, they could, you know, let other companies, other people, you know, latch onto that. But then one of the questions I was having was, okay, so, but how does it get better, right? If a company is using it for a specific case and it needs to be improved on in that specific case, right? Let's say they're, you know, monitoring lizards or something, some really niche case, and Tesla doesn't have a lot of lizards. Is there a way where, you know, Tesla can run a service where this stuff can be improved by the very developers, right, that are using it, to actually input these images, labels or something, where it could actually train the whole neural net to make it better? Is that too complicated, or is this something that's possible, you think?
It's not very easy with current technology for that kind of neural network to incrementally learn a new class. It kind of has to learn from scratch again. So typically training, human learning is incremental. So if you have to learn a new thing today, you can just kind of write that on top of your existing knowledge. You don't have to like delete or you know, start from scratch. But the way kind of neural networks typically is trained is that if your neural network has been trained on 100 lizards, and you need to learn a new class, the 101st lizard, you have to kind of train it. You basically add the 101st data set into your data pool, and you run it again to learn it, because it all sums up to a probability of one. So typically the way it's done is not very easy for that. You can do transfer learning, but you tend to forget the older stuff as well. And for GPT-3, to use that as an analogy, like there is no way the customer can augment the training data. OpenAI does everything, gives you an API, you have practically no control. You can condition your prompt and answers, but you can't add to their training data set. And you can't certainly do a little bit of incremental training as a customer and then use that as a custom solution to yourself. So I think it's not very easy. I think from a Tesla's perspective, instead of being that more flexible, I think it's more like addressing the low-hanging fruit of, if we can just offer this base layer computer vision, generalized computer vision model, let's see what you can do with it. And without doing any customization, GPT-3 has kind of proven out that model, even with no customization client side, actually works pretty well, can generate many useful use cases. You know, thousands of developers are working on it. So I think step one, you don't have to get too fancy. Just give people access to an incredibly robust vision model, and I'm sure they'll figure out what to do with it.
Yeah, that's kind of fascinating. Open, you know, GPT-3 for vision or real world. And I mean, just thinking about that is kind of interesting, because one of the challenges is, like, you know, the OpenAI, they were able to get billions and billions, you know, just text from everywhere on the internet to analyze and feed their neural nets. But in Tesla's case, it's more limited. It's a narrow niche of just driving, right? It's not really, because there's so many ways to interact with the real world that isn't just driving. And so it seems it's not as generalized as, for example, OpenAI's approach to language and text, all that stuff. It's more, and so it would seem like the big challenge to become a GPT-3 for real world is to get all of those different use cases of how the real world is interacting with each other. You know, there's like, it's not just cars in the real world, right?
So I think it's a vertical specific neural network, right? It's a driving, it's a generalized network for kind of driving. For general vision, yeah, it's like, it doesn't even have images of inside the house, right, by definition. So I think that is challenging. I think probably the most easiest adjacent industry it can do is to maybe license it to other automakers who need help, because they don't have, they have like less than 1% of Tesla's data set. So they could make that a kind of a licensing business to that industry vertical. That's probably the most obvious thing to do. But yeah, if you're a Toyota or GM, I think you would be at loath to license this piece of software from Tesla, who's already killed you, and now you're going to pay them to kill you more. But if you don't do it, like, what is your choice? You're going to use Intel Mobileye with like this chip, and there's not really a programmable stack, and still you have no data. It's like, there are not a lot of choices.
That's a rough one. I don't know what you do in that case. So I got several questions from Twitter followers regarding Cardano. It seems like people who've been following you have picked up on some criticism of Cardano. Kimono says, can he present his bear case regarding Cardano and why he thinks the vision behind Cardano is so flawed? Andre says, give a detailed explanation on his bearishness on Cardano. And yeah, there's several others. So yeah, what's your take? So for those who are joining in, right, there's the background is, you know, you have certain blockchains which are calling themselves third generation blockchains, right? So they're labeling, you know, Bitcoin as this first generation kind of store value, but the problem is you can't do much with this blockchain. The second generation they're labeling is Ethereum. You can put, you know, add on smart contracts, programmable code, basically in the blockchain. And some of these so-called third generation projects are criticizing Ethereum as being too slow, as like, hey, it's not scalable, gas fees are incredibly high, and they're not moving fast enough, right? So some third generation protocols like, let's say, Cardano and others are saying, hey, we're going to basically, you know, do kind of what Ethereum is doing, but doing it better. And then Ethereum is coming alongside and saying, hey, no, we have Ethereum 2.0. We've got this all figured out. We're going to lower gas fees, make it scalable, et cetera, no problem. And so what's your take on all of this? Do you think Ethereum has got it in the bag? Or is this something where, you know, there will be a lot of blockchains out there that do, you know, offer different value propositions? And yeah, what is your kind of background behind your critique of Cardano?
I don't have to defend my critique of Cardano. Cardano has to prove why it's worth anything at all. The onus is not on me. The onus is on Cardano.
Well, right? You could say that. We could say that with almost anything out there, right? For example, why is Ethereum worth $200 billion, or why is Bitcoin worth $1 trillion when it hasn't, let's say, proved its full use case, right? Sure. So everything in the crypto world is up to being proved. So I'm just curious, like,
that's
when
right. But if you look at Ethereum, it's like, why is it worth $200 billion? Well, there are $50 billion staked in Ethereum DeFi protocols. Thousands of developers are developing Ethereum. There's a complete like ENS system you can send money using Ethereum. Ethereum settles more value than Bitcoin. I can give you many stats on why Ethereum should justify its value. So where's the stat that says Cardano should be worth $35 billion? It's so weird. It's like somehow this thing right now, every time you ask a Cardano person, okay, what can you do with Cardano? They don't have an answer. But if you criticize it, they're like, bro, Cardano is the future. Why are you criticizing Cardano? I'm like, well, it's $35 billion. EA is worth about $35 billion. And EA entertains hundreds of millions of people daily in the world. It's built classic, iconic titles. Name me one application that runs on Cardano. I actually looked because, you know, Charles Hoskinson tweeted out this beautiful like lumograph of the Cardano ecosystem. And there are universities, there are research partners. There's no box called applications. I think there might have been like some deployed things. And then inside of that little box, there was this thing called New Balance. I'm like, New Balance? What does New Balance have to do with Cardano? So I actually spent some time to look into it. It's like, okay, maybe I shouldn't just like troll people on Twitter. I'll look into it.
Okay. So let's take a step back here. Because, I mean, okay, so like a few things. First off, with Cardano, they haven't even... Okay, so the way I look at Cardano is, I mean, I'm not an expert by any means on it, but they've rolled out kind of a timeline that relatively they've stuck with. And they haven't even... You know, part of their timeline was smart contracts would be coming later this year. So therefore, when you critique them for not having applications run on their protocol, the whole thing from a Cardano's perspective, like, hey, what are you talking about? This is all planned out to be rolled out later this year. Like, there wasn't smart contract support last year or even up until now. So for you to critique that there aren't applications running on it, it's like, it doesn't even, you know...
Call me old-fashioned. Yeah. I don't think the roadmap should be worth $35 billion. If I put together a PowerPoint that says James Wang chain will support smart contracts in 2025, should my protocol be worth $35 billion? That's ridiculous.
Okay. But you could use the same, I guess, a lot of this logic could be used against Ethereum too. For example, Ethereum 2.0, who cares? The protocol doesn't matter. It means zero. So Ethereum, as it stands right now with its gas fees, right, and all this stuff, is it really worth $200 billion? You could say a lot of the value of Ethereum is in its future, right? In what it can become, where it's leading to, right? So it's the same logic in some ways, no?
I agree with you. Yes, everything is valued based on its future kind of potential. It's just, and how you evaluate the future is a kind of credible assessment of whether it will happen in the future. Ethereum has credibility for that future prospect because it has, if the team has demonstrated shipping real stuff in the present and in the past. Ethereum 2.0 is not strictly, Ethereum wasn't always worth $200 billion, right? A year ago, Ethereum was worth like $40 billion. So why has Ethereum increased in value to be worth $200 billion? Because in part, because it has shipped so much stuff. So Cardano will get its valuation when it ships, like if the valuation is fair, except it is getting its valuation before it's shipped even the basics.
Okay, so
Ethereum shipped the version, the first part of its 2.0 roadmap in December of last year. So it is delivering on its promises and its valuation is increasing roughly commensurate with its shipping of software updates. Cardano is shipping New Balance shoes with a tracker to authenticate authenticity of New Balance shoes. That program has now terminated. New Balance is no longer using Cardano to verify the authenticity of New Balance shoes. What is the new application for Cardano?
Like a lot of this, okay, so I hope you're open to just like just chilling a bit or talking, you know, about all this stuff from different angles. But in a way, like when you say that Ethereum has value because it's proven its, you know, adoption, et cetera, but if you think about it, just this like recent 10x from all the cryptos, like it's been like everything, like Bitcoin or, you know, Ethereum, Cardano. So it's not so much, I would say, like, oh, Ethereum has proved itself, therefore that was the reason for this big bump. A lot of it was a generalized interest and move into, yes, into crypto itself. And so Cardano was one of those recipients of a big price jump. Ethereum was too, but everything got jumped, right? So in a way, this critique of Cardano could be used for many. Are you critical of all this, all these altcoins and all these like this different stuff that you don't think has the utility yet?
I am, but the reason why I picked on Cardano is because it's funny, firstly, okay? And two, it is the highest valuation one. So if you're gonna pick, like if 10 students are all misbehaving, you're gonna pick the one that's most misbehaving and make an example out of him. And Cardano is the top, like, for example, like last cycle, people were criticizing, you know, things like Ripple. And Ripple now is up there too. But plenty of people are already, you know, ripping on Ripple. And I don't feel like I need to add anything there. But Cardano talks a lot of big talk. Ripple is not saying we're going to add smart contracts, right? Cardano is right here, number six in the coin market cap list. $35 billion. It's like...
But they haven't, they're not the ones that said we deserve this / let's pump up our price. I mean, Charles Hoskinson has come up publicly and saying, hey, you know, this is you know, the higher it goes, the worse it is. Like he wants to lower expectations in some ways. Okay. I mean, here's another angle, developer mindshare. Okay. So, next to Ethereum, what would be, you think, the blockchain that is gathering the most interest, the curiosity, even though, I mean, I would say Cardano is definitely one of those where it's saying, hey, developers are saying, hey, what can we do on this? And in the next year, because here's the thing, their whole rollout and plan was to, you know, this year is to be the big year of rolling out, for example, your own native currencies, smart contracts, etc. But I mean, shouldn't we wait a little bit on the whole question of adoption to see how many developers jump on board, develop applications before we you know, conclude this is, you know, a failure or not? I mean, market cap aside, because market cap, I can make very similar arguments for a lot of things, you know? Sure. I could say they're way ahead of where they should be. But I'm just saying, shouldn't we evaluate Cardano for, you know, what it's, you know, trying to do, basically?
I just don't have any reason to give it the benefit of the doubt on any of the things on its roadmap. Like, I don't see why it deserves that benefit of the doubt. And I think your point that everything else is also betting on the future, is not, if you compare it to other chains that aim to be a better Ethereum, they deliver more content and application. They shipped more real stuff and they're at lower valuations. That's why I picked Cardano. Take Cosmos. Cosmos is a, call it, you know, next third generation protocol that's supposed to be solving many of the problems of Ethereum. Cosmos has real users Cosmos has entire other blockchains built based on that protocol. Where is Cosmos in the list? It's number 29 in CoinMarketCap with a valuation of about $5 billion. It's worth like 1/7 of Cardano. So like, why do I pick on Cardano? Because it shipped practically nothing and it is like 5-10x more valuable than other blockchains that have arguably, you know, very similar characteristics and similar kind of problems to be solved with real adoption. Rune is built on Cosmos. Terra is built on Cosmos. Like, if I talk about Cosmos, no one's badgering me about Cosmos. But Cardano, like, part of the reason is there's a whole legion of Cardano fanboys on Twitter just pumping the price. You know, Charles Hoskinson might have said, oh, it's too expensive and we should calm down. But they're not calming down. Like, to them, Cardano is their get to the moon ticket. And yeah, I know this is a mentality for Ripple, for Dogecoin, for everything. But those are not serious projects. Cardano builds itself as a serious project. So if you're going to be serious, then I'm going to, like examine you more severely than Doge. I never commented on Doge. I don't care. I get it. It's a meme coin. Like, it, the fact that it goes up is funny. But Cardano is not trying to be funny. Cardano thinks it's actually serious. So deliver me some smart contracts. Give me something other than New Balance shoes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I understand your perspective. I guess the whole thing is, in a world where, for example, there is a lot of hype, you know, mm-hmm. and for example, I mean, you could apply a lot of these things to Ethereum itself, where, you know, Ethereum 2.0, there's a lot of question marks on, hey, is this really going to work at what, you know?
Dave, yeah. Beacon Chain shipped in December. Tens of billions mm-hmm. of dollars staked on Beacon Chain. It's not a question.
Yeah, it's but real. It's still, yeah, I'm just saying that the whole, you know, process, right, of Ethereum 2.0, I mean, that's just the beginning stage, right, of, you know,
like
different stages.
Like Ethereum 2.0 as a hope, using Hopium. Yeah. Right, that was last year, and Ethereum was worth less than $100 billion last year. Like, it's reality ultimately at some point catches up with valuation. I mean, Ethereum has, yes, everything has increased since January and February. We had a massive like spike in crypto valuations for many reasons, and maybe that's a case to say Ethereum is undervalued because, you know, crap coins are up 10x, Ethereum is up maybe, you know, 5-7x, and it's actually shipped stuff, right? Whereas all the nonsense coins have shipped nothing. They've just became memes, right? So, I mean, I you could argue Ethereum is undervalued relative to fundamentals, but you have other blockchains that have shipped nothing since last year. Their valuations increased 10x. And if you're not serious about it, then it's a funny joke. But if you're serious about it and you're like, we're going to be the next Ethereum, like we're, you know, peer reviewed and all this other stuff, then let's have it. Then I'm going to have some fun with you. It's like, it's funny. Those people sure. seem to very easily triggered if you criticize them at all.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I'm just, for me, I'm just like, you know, an observer looking at yeah. some of this stuff saying, hey, you know, it feels like there is some frustration in the Ethereum world of high gas fees. And, you know, like Ethereum 2.0 is supposed to deliver on that promise to lower it significantly. But there is this pent up demand of, or this questioning of, hey, can there be a better Ethereum? And I think that's part of the reason why a Cardano or even a lot of these other, you know, blockchains are getting great or high valuations, because there is that sense of this unknownness of what is it going to look like a few years down the road. I mean, yeah,
I think it's pretty well, I think the reason why Cardano is pumping is because it's a dollar. I think that's its primary feature. Its primary feature is it has a low unit price, so psychologically it's very pumpable. When you have something else that's, you know, $50, $300, and same thing with Dogecoin. Dogecoin is like 23 cents right now, right? Things with low unit prices are highly pumpable and highly digestible for kind of retail money. So that's its primary feature. Like, why is other coins with better reputations lower? Because it's you know, it's not as, its unit price is actually much higher. If you look at the merit of, if you're, I don't think it has to do with gas prices. I think because Cardano was built the spec and everything was built 3 years ago. Ethereum gas prices a year ago was 1/10 of what it is right now. So it's not like it's all of a sudden coming in to save Ethereum from gas prices. There is real pressure with gas prices, but Cardano is certainly not the solution for that. I mean, you can't even, there's nothing to even run on it, right? And to more of what Ethereum has done to alleviate gas prices. First, we've had this kind of like, I think gas prices now are lower than a month ago. So there's been some like bot action that's kind of driven that down. Second, Ethereum layer twos, which are the things that will basically give efficiencies to transactions, bundle them together off chain and then back on chain. Those have shipped. Like, this is not a roadmap. Layer 2 on Ethereum has shipped and is working today. I used Loopring 2 days ago, layer 2. Granted, the rates are not as good as layer 1, but like, that is a shipped solution. Polygon is live on Aave. Like, those things are live. Those are layer 2s and sidechains. Cardano is still like not shipped even the basics. So yeah, I will be critical on Cardano. And right. I think it's, yeah.
All right, we'll see actually. This year is going to be an interesting year, I think. I don't know. It feels like developers are anxious to try things out, you know, and even, you know, a lot of Ethereum developers are actually willing to try something out on an alternative blockchain. So, I mean, yep. It doesn't seem that...
The solution is BNB, right? Binance blockchain is the real, like, practical solution to the gas problem. Like, run your software on CZ's personal mainframe in his basement. That will save you money. Like, if you don't care about decentralization, that is how you save on gas fees, and people are actually using it. But we'll see how durable that is. They've already run into scalability issue.
Yeah, definitely. All right. So what we wanted to open it up for some live Q&A here on all things crypto. I think we've lit some flames here. We've done a round on Bitcoin, a round on Cardano. Maybe there'll be some folks who have some questions. So here's the format. If you're wanting to ask a question for this Q&A section, go ahead and write in all caps, question colon, and then write your question. What I'll do is I'll be monitoring the chat section. So I've already told James I won't be completely like eyes on him the whole time. So, you know, this is just the reality of hosting live questions. But we'll go ahead and we'll try to shoot as many questions as possible, actually, to James to kind of give people as much opportunity to ask questions. So, Zach Taylor, question. What if Ethereum is like the email networks of the early 2000s, stuck in a situation where they are important and have a huge network effect, yet they struggle to monetize their network?
Email does not collect fees to use the protocol. Ethereum collects fees to use its protocol. That's the gas price. So Ethereum is already monetized, and by definition, it won't have this problem.
Okay, got it. So there's monetization issue. Zach Taylor again says, if he believes that the first product in a market is never the winner, why does he believe Ethereum is the winner in the DeFi space because it was the first?
I don't believe it is the winner. It's the emergent, it's the dominant one right now. That can certainly change. Right now, Ethereum has a certain developer density, and I would say its developer loyalty and density is kind of similar to what Windows had early, you know, late 90s. And Windows is still relevant today, even though many things have happened, right? So I think if you can get a certain density of developers who are loyal to the platform and build applications on that, and you establish a standard that everyone else is programming to, I think that gives it a good chance of having longevity. But overall, I'm not religious about Ethereum like being the long-term winner. I think it is a good point that the first tends to not be the best. And Ethereum, actually, the way it works is actually similar to a mainframe in that it's one runtime, one state across all computers. So we could certainly see third-gen blockchains challenge that notion, and we'll see how much utility it is. I think the prime candidates there are essentially Cosmos and Polkadot, and we'll see how far they go.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is your framework more like the most innovative, the fastest, the blockchains, the protocols that are, you know, providing the most value ultimately will, you know, win out? Like, it's a hyper competitive world and the best will win. Is that kind of your attitude?
I actually know it's not. Often the best don't win in tech. Mm-hmm. Because if you're competing purely on features, I think you're missing a lot on realities having to do with either preferences or other intangible things like developers, right? I think like you rarely beat the existing thing by having better specs than the existing thing. Like when the Microsoft Zune came out against the iPod, it was like, oh, we have color screens, or we have more gigabytes, we have more battery life. You're never going to win by offering like speeds and feeds that's better than the old one. And that's why I think these second, third gen blockchains that's aim merely to be a better Ethereum with like, we are just like Ethereum, but we support this and we have lower gas fees. That is not a very smart way to kind of compete. You want to compete on something on a different axis of differentiation. So I think whatever kind of challenges Ethereum will offer something that Ethereum fundamentally, by its definition, can't do. Just like how Ethereum challenged Bitcoin by fundamentally offering this thing called full programmability via, you know, EVM that Bitcoin can't do. So you got to offer a new thing.
Mm-hmm. Lee K says, what are some of the pitfalls of ETH?
Pitfalls of ETH. I mean, obviously, short term right now is gas prices. The overall, if I zoom out, like ultimately, like the big question versus ETH versus anything else is the world a kind of single chain dominant future or a multi-chain dominant future? And the bull case for Ethereum would be Ethereum is kind of a base layer like the internet and everything is built on top and around it. The bear case is it is the first version and it has a very specific set of trade-offs of security and programmability and storage, and different applications need different benefit from different trade-offs. So you will need like every blockchain design is a set of, like, if there are five knobs, you know, like you set the knobs a certain way, and maybe you like it this way, and maybe that's good for a certain class of things. But you can totally set the knobs a different way, and you have different levels of security, scalability, and kind of apps that you can make on top. I think the bear case would be, in the real world, it turns out you need a lot of different kind of parameters of these blockchains for different verticals and use cases, and you would want to do that. And one blockchain does not fit all. In that case, I think the multi-chain thesis comes more into the foreground, and things like Cosmos and Polkadot would become relevant. I think the fact that we've already gotten some traction on the Cosmos ecosystem, in creating things like Luna, in creating things like Rune, as well as like BNB, like all these are Cosmos-based systems. I think that is already indicating that people want, like, just like there are many Linux distributions, people want a way to kind of like customize it and make it their own. And Cosmos is like this custom SDK where you can kind of create your own distribution, your own version, and then they connect together via you know, the Cosmos IBC. So if there's plurality in the world in the future, I think Ethereum will be one of many rather than one of one. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Here's a few questions. Zaib Commerce says, any thoughts on Solana? And a few others have asked about Solana here.
Yeah, I'm not too familiar with Solana. I've only had a very brief look. It seems to be also in the school of being a better blockchain than Ethereum, very low gas fees. I think it's hard to exist as an independent island. I think if you're going to talk about third alternate Ethereums, you should assume there to be many of these. I think you should not, even if you're a Solana bull, you should not assume that Solana will win at the expense of other things and kind of take over. Anyone who believes in a pluralistic outcome should assume there's meant, like, Solana will coexist with Cosmos, with maybe Polkadot, with Ethereum, with Bitcoin. Like, it's either one or many, but it can't be two, right? It doesn't make sense. So I think I think Solana probably, if it works, will be one set of parameters that's good for developers. Some people will use it. Ideally, it connects to IBC, the bridge with Cosmos, and it works with everyone else. Like, think of it as the global trade system. You don't want to be like a lone island. You want to be connected to everyone else. Maybe you want to be Singapore. Maybe you want to be London. Maybe you want to be like the US. Maybe you're dominant, but like there will be many, and there will be like trade routes. And I think that's why the interconnect matters and things like IPC matter.
Mm-hmm. A Village says, question, any thoughts on Dapper Labs? So for those who don't know, Dapper Labs makes NBA Top Shots, the NFT of collectible NBA, you know, virtual cards. So what are your thoughts on them? They just raised a round, I think, for like what, valuation of like $6 billion or something. I mean, what's going on here?
Yeah, they found the best use case for NFTs monetization using an existing medium people respect, NBA Top Shots. I don't have any specific thoughts on it. I think this is a case of, people have always wondered whether value, one big meta question for blockchains is, does the value accrue to these applications built on top, or does it accrue to the base layer like Ethereum? I think Dapper is a great example of high value accruing to the application. And that, if nothing else on Dapper itself, means that kind of like, the applications are also a very investable space, And, you know, people don't have to just make it all about investing in base protocols.
Mm-hmm. Julong Chen says, can Doge hit $1?
Probably. It's at 25 cents now, so 23 cents now. So
yeah,
probably.
Yeah. What's your take on these meme coins? Is it just like it goes wherever the mob takes it to? Or, and I mean, how do you process all this stuff?
Think about the job to be done for meme coins, right? Like, meme coins it's a community generated lottery. If you buy a lottery ticket at the lottery store, your chances are determined by, you know, the universe. You have no control over that. It's by the ticketing organization. People want some agency. People want agency. People want community. Dogecoin and Supermoon are lotteries that give the user agency and community. That's why they're popular.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is it sustainable? Like, you know, can it grow to actually become like a real currency? Like, you know, where it's adopted and, you know, people are tipping with Doge, and or is it just something that it just doesn't have the foundation, you think?
It's very unlikely because that's a subset of these people are a subset of population. They're not representative of majority population. So I don't see it crossing the chasm.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Jazz Dillon says ETH gas fees versus BNB, Binance Smart Chain and DeFi projects being built on them. So yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, ETH gas fees are high because you're paying for a higher level of security. Binance Smart Chain gas fees are low because you're trusting CZ. So you get what you pay for.
Mm-hmm. Josh Han says, do you think that public companies will use their balance sheet to buy ETH? Who do you think will announce a BTC purchase next?
I don't know who will, but I think overall the secular trend is more and more, right? We've seen that happen already. The first company to really buy ETH is Meitu out of China. That's a very, I think, like, that's great foresight on the part of the CEO. I think it will be very unconventional for a while for people to buy ETH on the balance sheet because, you know, even Bitcoin is such a leap of faith right now. But it would not be out of the question that if monetary policy gets a little out of hand, this could become the norm. I think Bitcoin could easily, I think some company buying Bitcoin today on the balance sheet is almost not controversial after Tesla. At some point, we could see baskets of currencies added to the balance sheet so as to not appear controversial. So what's happening in crypto now, like we have ETFs in the stock market, there are now the equivalent of ETFs for cryptocurrency. So DPI is a great example. It's DeFi's Pulse Index. It's a basket of tokens that run DeFi on Ethereum. So if you buy DPI, you get broad exposure to DeFi without having to pick between, you know, Aave and Compound, things like that. So companies could conceivably buy aggregate value tokens like that and put it on their balance sheet so as to not express opinion about, you know, or speculating on a specific coin.
Interesting. Adrian says, views on Polkadot.
I don't know enough about Polkadot. I've spent more time with Cosmos, but it seems like they have very similar goals. Except Cosmos has empirical adoption, whereas Polkadot is more, I don't know, more like Cardano in the sense that it has a first-tier founder from Ethereum. It has a lot of good press, has a very high valuation, but it's still like valuation is mostly pegged on kind of future adoption.
Mm-hmm. Watched up Blue Zebra Bar says, question, the future of NFTs. How do you process NFTs? Where is this whole thing headed?
I think NFTs, we're in a local bubble of just, we just invented this thing and everyone is kind of milking it for what it is. I think it's very difficult to predict the future of NFTs. It is just too emergent as a technology. I think the only maybe certain thing that we can say is that it's going to be extremely important in multiplayer games. I think games built in the future will have NFT support natively, and the in-game items will have a marketplace outside of the games themselves. That's the most like direct application for NFTs. Things that cannot be traded, all things being equal, have lower value than things that can be traded, because the ability to sell the thing to another party is a first order feature. It's a highly desirable trait. So today's game engines or game universes kind of basically constrain the item to that specific instance of the game. If the items can exist in the wide internet on OpenSea, the value of that item increases immediately. So I think all games are going to want to adopt a standard where their stuff is not a proprietary unit that only exists in the game, but is a credibly neutral unit that can exist in a marketplace on the internet. And I think that in a way can be the bridge to the metaverse, because the metaverse, the whole point is that multiple universes are connected together. There's some kind of a thread that ties them together. And if it's commerce is the best thread of human culture, always, right? If you go back 100 years, 1,000 years, what ties everything together between these continents, even when we had terrible ghetto-ass like sailing boats, is commerce. We want to just sell stuff and trade stuff. NFTs are kind of like the trade routes of these different game engines and game universes, and it's going to establish commerce between them.
Mm-hmm. With metaverses, like who do you see might be the big winners with kind of metaverse? I mean, you've got, you know, different, you know, games like Fortnite and et cetera. You have like Roblox doing a different kind of platform approach. Are there any exciting companies or, you know, trends or things with metaverses that you're excited about?
I think Epic is the only one doing a pretty like first rate effort at metaverse. They have it basically kind of as their strategy and mission statement. They're very much tied up fighting Apple. That's regrettable. I wouldn't be surprised if the most important metaverse company hasn't been created yet. I think we're potentially looking at the early batch of social media companies. We're looking at Friendster and whatnot. I'm not sure the first real, the one that's going to win even exists yet. So I think probably should not pin too much hope on the current batch. I think the current batch are kind of a experimentation batch, and potentially the real winner is yet to come.
Mm-hmm. We've got a ton of questions that are super interesting. Here's another one. Priya Jalili says, what are your top three crypto positions?
I don't like to talk about personal positions, but I think you can probably tell I like Ethereum. I think the Cosmos ecosystem is very interesting. I don't have a position on that. I think Thorchain is very expensive right now. I think it's very fair to say most of it is hopium. It's like, hopefully it'll realize its vision, but it has shipped mainnet. It works. So it deserves like some real valuation, but it's still very expensive right now. But I think Thorchain could be very, very big. I mean, if it works, it has every reason to be bigger than Uniswap.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're very bullish though on Ethereum, right?
I've been tweeting about Ethereum for 2 months straight.
Yeah, when I hear that, I'm like, oh, okay. It sounds like all in Ethereum. I don't know. I'm just kidding. Giving you a hard time here. You tweeted that you kind of have restricted your trading to what, weekly now? I said, or monthly, or what is it? Like
once a month.
Okay. I know. Like back in the day, I think it was Jesse Livingston, the famous trader. He only traded like at the end of the week, usually, I think, or something crazy, once a week or something. But what was your background? Why are you only trading once a month? Was it a problem, like just kind of trading in and out daily and all the fluctuations?
If you look at the price every day and you think you can trade every day, you generate a lot of like activity for yourself, and you tend to act on weak signals in the market. And I basically tracked my decisions in my last couple of weeks, and they were pretty bad. They're pretty bad. Like every time I thought there was a top, it wasn't. Every time I followed a trade, it crashed. Like I was like, actually, my short-term trading, I basically measured myself and said, you're doing a bad job. You're better off. In fact, not, if you didn't do the things you did, you'd be better off. So I basically am putting this in place. Previously, I had this thing of only trading once a quarter. Couldn't do it. But I think if you restrict it either to some time interval, a week, a month, whatever, you will increase the quality of your trades. You will not act on weak signals, and you will be less likely to do something rash, like sell at the bottom during a flash crash, like what happened with Ethereum like a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Venice says, oh man, I just deleted the question. Let's go to Max. It says, how big will DeFi be in the future? I mean, you kind of paralleled this whole $3 trillion kind of, you know, financial system. Is that just US or, I mean, global? Wouldn't it be more than that? I'm just curious.
It's revenue. So market cap.
Okay, got it. So, I mean, do you see, like, what's the progression do you see? I mean, another question I actually had was, what inning do you think we're in terms of DeFi?
Oh, like, not even the first inning, maybe the first inning. That's not the same as price. Like, these, we could be, in terms of adoption, not talking token prices, we've barely begun, right? We have $50 billion locked in DeFi. Incredible adoption over 1 year, but, like, that's nothing. That is absolutely nothing. No business is being built on DeFi money today, right? It's mostly within the crypto ecosystem. So we've barely started. We've basically proven it works right now. The most material addition in DeFi that's happened recently is MakerDAO announcing that they're taking real world collateral. So MakerDAO is a, call it crypto bank based on Ethereum. Up to this point, they've mostly taken Ethereum as the collateral. So you give it some Ethereum you have, and you can withdraw some stablecoin in the form of DAI. Over the years, they've added a few other tokens, such as Wrapped BTC, Wrapped Bitcoin, and that's been nice. But this year, they added real-world assets. So a real estate company is basically, it's in the business of fixing up houses and then selling them, flipping houses. They are now collateralizing real estate as a token that you can deposit into the Maker system as collateral, and then extract, take out DAI stablecoin. So this is a very meaningful like step, because we're connecting now with the real economy. But this is the kind of stuff we have to do over decades, like connecting the real GDP with the kind of crypto GDP.
Mm-hmm. Recently, Binance announced that they're allowing tokenized stock sales, right, or trading, starting with Tesla. Like, how are they doing that, and like, what's the future of this?
Yeah, so one of the five use cases I mentioned was buying stocks outside of the stock exchanges in your domestic kind of country. So, you know, people in Thailand can't buy Tesla. And if you're in the US, you think, oh, we have all the tech stocks. If there's a hot new Indian or Chinese IPO, you can't buy that either. So even though the financial system is global, it's actually still heavily siloed by country when it comes down to the mechanics of ownership. And these regulations are highly partitioned by country. What you want is like a truly globalized stock exchange or marketplace, so that, you know, who cares if it's a stock in Thailand or a stock in Nigeria? Like, that should be universally available, because, you know, we're just using the internet. But current regulations won't let you do that. So the blockchain folks are very clever, and they found ways of basically generating synthetic assets that mirror the price movements of the underlying stocks. The first one to do it at a stock level was basically a protocol called Mirror. This runs on the Terra blockchain. And they launched like one for Tesla, one for Amazon. Essentially, these are called synthetic assets. So basically, someone has to short that stock Mirror blockchain in order to create an open position that allows someone to buy. And basically, you need two parties for this to work. And you know, there are fees involved, and it's not the same as owning the underlying. It's literally a contract in the cloud, if you will. And what was I going to say? And you need a counterparty. So, but generally speaking, this allows people to buy things not in their domestic country. And the number one country that uses Mirror Protocol is Thailand. So it's very interesting that, you know, we may not even know why people have where and why they would want to own a certain stock. But this feature, synthetics tracking kind of real world assets, is available on the Mirror blockchain, which is based on Terra, and it's available in synthetics. Recently, they were first into commodities, you know, synthetic gold, synthetic silver. Now they're doing it for stocks as well. I think BNB probably is working on that. But this is a clear use case of breaking down barriers because of using the blockchain, since the blockchain is international. Stock exchanges are national.
Mm-hmm. A few other questions on different blockchains. So Diffusion 33 says, question, thoughts on VeChain? And then Vikrant says, actually, James Wong says, thoughts on Chainlink?
No thoughts on VeChain. I don't know anything about it. Chainlink, I think, is extremely interesting. I think there are two protocols that have that serve a very critical function on as a, if you think of an investment thesis, you can invest in kind of base layer protocols like Ethereum. You can invest in applications like Dapper Labs, Flow, or you can invest in, call it tool providers, middleware, right? And in the traditional IT landscape, there's a similar stack. You can invest in the infrastructure, AWS. You can invest in applications like Salesforce, or you can invest in kind of intermediate like tooling layers like Twilio and Snowflake. Like the intermediate layer, the tooling layer, is also starting to emerge for Web3 and blockchains. And the two that are, I think, clearly getting Chainlink by far is the most prominent one, mostly because they have an army of frogs on Twitter. I'm kidding. Mostly because like everyone uses them, and if you don't use it, the frogs will go after you. But essentially, what it is an oracle. Oracle is a way to get real world data and information verified and transmitted to the blockchain. So, for example, to generate a synthetic token of Tesla so that people in Thailand can buy Tesla, the blockchain, the Ethereum blockchain or the Mirror blockchain, needs to know what the price of Tesla is in the stock market. How do you do that? You need some kind of conduit to the real world, right? Because you can't just exist in this cloud. So these oracles will basically aggregate sources in the real world, whether it's Yahoo Finance or Google Finance or major original kind of trading tickers out of the NASDAQ. They will take various signals and then generate the kind of oracle or the kind of ground truth of what a piece of information is. And feed that to the blockchain so that application in the blockchain can simply query an API and say, what is the price of Tesla? And it will reliably get that data without, building very fragile integrations with like Yahoo Finance. So Chainlink is by far the dominant oracle provider, a software middleware that will provide you with real world data feeds onto the blockchain. And essentially, like practically everyone is using Chainlink. If you're not using Chainlink, you're probably using Band protocol, but like Chainlink, massive dominance. It's not exactly the same parallel, but it feels kind of like Twilio. Every company in SaaS doing communications use Twilio as kind of the fabric to communicate outwards. This one's inwards, but it's like this very essential and widely used middleware. So I think really strong position. I don't know how to evaluate yet. I haven't gotten to that point. Today it's number two CoinMarketCap, $14 billion. Twilio is like $50 billion. But Chainlink does not generate anything like the revenue of Twilio. So a lot of these are very expensive, and a lot of it is built on Hopium. But I think in terms of delivered value, like Chainlink delivers way more value than Cardano.
It's fascinating how much is at stake, because the price movements are all determined by the hype, and it's definitely lots of noise as well. Who do you follow to make sense of what's going on in crypto? Because there's so many new projects, there's so many changes, there's so much things happening. Are there any good Twitter accounts, or are there any good newsletters, any good data sources? Like, what's your go-to?
Sure. I think if you're interested in Bitcoin, there's a bunch of people, but I think people past that. If you want to follow the Ethereum space, the best two sources is Bankless, which is a channel built by Ryan and Dave, and they put out a wonderful newsletter, wonderful YouTube video, wonderful, just really accessible written content on everything that's happening with Ethereum. And the spirit of Bankless is, of course, you can do all the things that banking used to do with Ethereum, and they give you a great roadmap for that. So they really helped me a lot I think they're the best general onboarding mechanism to learn about Ethereum. If you want to be more hardcore and kind of stay even closer, Anthony Sassano puts out a daily newsletter and a daily video, and I consume that almost as my morning kind of coffee soundtrack, and that's great as well. So those are two great resources for the Ethereum ecosystem. Of course, lots of protocols out there to follow. I curated a Twitter list. So if you go to my Twitter, I have a list in my list section under my profiles called Crypto, and that's my personal curated list of something like 200 people in the crypto space that are very close and have that are very deep into like Chainlink, or some are deep into Luna. It's like the who's and who's of crypto. But I've made it very like very broad spectrum, in the sense that it's not a list of only the authority figures, you know, the famous VCs and the famous prominent accounts. I will follow people who are AAA tier, right down to like an Anon frog with 300 followers on Twitter, if they have some kind of unique insight. So if you want to get a raw feed with all the glory and all the guts as well, I think that list is what you want.
Mm-hmm. So we'll have a few kind of fun comments. Seth still says BTC is Yahoo, ETH is Google. NGME says BTC is gold, ETH is oil. That's, I'm not getting that one. Yeah, there's
BTC is a rock and Ethereum is a computer.
So another question here is Vic Krant says, does ETH have a better or worse chance of being regulated than BTC?
I would say less, for the simple reason that it's less prominent and it doesn't make a bold frontal claim of undermining or replacing the monetary system. So it has a less adversarial positioning vis-a-vis the establishment. And Bitcoin people are way too into that. So I think Ethereum has less regulatory attracts less regulatory scrutiny, except for DeFi applications right now. Those may attract specific kind of regulatory pressure.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like in some ways, like Bitcoin, at least certain camps of Bitcoin, it's very like the adversary is the government, the Fed, you know, yeah. The printing, the monetary supply.
They're also scared shitless of Ethereum. Like mm-hmm. Bitcoin people have clubhouses that just like are tracking Ethereum price movements. Their whole narrative is on being the only one. So they care. Mm-hmm. They obsess over Ethereum. Ethereum people don't think about Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. So I have a frequent guest on my channel, Emmett Peppers. We do kind of almost a weekly chat. And one of the things we were talking about last week on our chat was this concept of a possible huge Bitcoin crash 5 or 6 years down the road. Let's say it just continues to go up, up, up. You know, let's say it hits whatever ridiculous amounts, $1 million or whatever. And then there's like a crazy crash. Who knows what the circumstance, but let's say it's down 80% or something, right? But let's say at that time, let's say it's 2026 or 2027, you have a lot of institutions who have bought into Bitcoin, and they've lost billions and tens and maybe hundreds of billions of dollars, and the federal government has to step in and bail out these institutions who bought too much Bitcoin with federal money. And it's like the irony of the whole situation is, you know, like in a sense, Bitcoin has to be bailed out. What are your thoughts on a possible great Bitcoin crash in the future? I mean, in some ways, volatility is like, that's part of the nature of the game, because the future is so unknown. It's like, it could be the biggest thing, or, you know, it could be not the biggest thing. And that determines a lot of the present value of an asset. But it seems like, and one of the common themes, like we've seen just even in our talk, is this whole concept of demand pumping price, right? So you have price being a function of demand or popularity or whatever it is, right? And versus, let's say, you know, utility. But in a sense, isn't utility kind of under demand or popularity? Meaning, like, doesn't what really matters is what people want? Like, the utility, as you're saying, sometimes the best thing doesn't even win out, you know? Isn't the ultimate truth, like, what people want? And it seems like because of that, the nature of how a lot of these, you know, digital assets are scarce, and the nature of the pumping mechanism where you buy it, you want to pump it and degrade everything else. It just seems like it's just chaos. I don't say chaos, but it seems like, is this the new world that we're living in of crypto investing? That's just like, you know, manic and just, I don't know, everyone's shilling their own thing.
I think you got to like separate a little bit of the shill army with the reality. serious people working in crypto quit their high-paying six-figure jobs at FANG to work on crypto, and they cannot be retained. And once you move to crypto, you don't go back. You know, Google loses people to crypto. Crypto does not lose people to Google. It's just a one-way street. It's a black hole. For those people, all these dynamics, that's just noise, right? It's like you have to think of the crypto participants as very unique demographics or personas. You have hardcore, some of the best computer science people in the world working on protocols and protocol design. You have some of the best entrepreneurs building applications and scaling growth. They're here for real. And then separately, you have a bucket of like, you know, GMEs and frogs and things pumping coins because it's high agency, high community lottery tickets. And that's very attractive. That's a huge product improvement over existing lottery tickets. So they're free to do their thing. They're going to pump anything with a low unit price. They're going to enjoy it. You know, that's entertainment for them. That's separate. But generally, as an asset grows in value, volatility decreases because it costs too much money to kind of to move the price. So I think as something like Bitcoin, Ethereum matures, the volatility overall is going to decrease over time. And that's why these pumpers, the people who pump like Dogecoin are not interested in Bitcoin or Ethereum because they can't move the price. So the low market cap stuff is where they're going to do their thing and have fun. And the high market cap stuff will mature software ecosystems and will attract, I think, talent to actually build it. And eventually we'll be all using it without knowing it. And then it kind of will stabilize. But we are so early in that. And that's why I think it's interesting. It's to be early in that. And to be able to, if you can put up with the volatility, that's how you make these kind of life-changing gains.
Mm-hmm. Price movements, you know, there's lots of different things that affect or impact, let's say, a crash or, you know, a pump or different things. And are there any good, like, kind of, who's the best kind of thinker or mind out there you've seen that kind of can really unpack what's happening with just like, for example, manipulation or different activities by whales, et cetera, to impact price movement? Is there anyone that comes on the top off the top of your head?
There's a group of people on crypto Twitter who are technicians. I think it's very difficult and hard to follow and unpack. And it's very easy to, I would not recommend people get down that road. Short-term price movements are just not a very dependable way of, they take up a lot of your time and it's, you don't even know if they generate greater than 50% odds for a long time. So unless you're a specialist trader, I would just stay away from it in general. But I would, if you want to really engage with that, in my crypto list as well, there are a bunch of people who are focused on charts and on-chain metrics. They're pretty good at analyzing that kind of stuff.
Cool. Julia Saavedra says, ask him about Ben Goertzel and the Singularity.net project on Cardano. Do you know anything about that Singularity.net project?
I don't. I've heard of Ben. Ben talks a lot about AI, but he's a nice guy, but I don't think he's shipped anything that has really moved the state of the art in AI for the AI community. He worked on like a AI hedge fund. I'm not sure if that's even still online. He built a robot called Sophia, which is highly misleading in a sense. It's kind of like an Alexa with a head, which is like, that's still an Alexa. You know, it's not smart. I would not say he has the best reputation, but he seems like a nice guy. I don't want to say anything too personal.
Yeah. I've gotten several requests to interview Ben on my channel. So I've reached out and hopefully I can get him on. Overall, this has actually been a fun chat and just covering a bunch of different topics, getting people's different views and stuff and having some fun here. Wanted to thank you, James, for joining and sharing kind of your insights on this fast moving, you know, field. I'm sure in 3 or 6 months or a year, right, a lot of things are going to be different. You know, we'll probably see things different, but just to give people a real time glimpse of what's happening in our thoughts, it's been helpful. I'll go ahead and link to your Twitter profile in the video description below. Sure. So people can follow you there. Anywhere else, you know, do you have a, you said you have a newsletter, right? How can people sign up for that?
Yeah, just go to my Twitter profile. It's the first link in my profile. I'll occasionally write stuff on crypto. Last one was on the kind of 5 use cases you can use it today. And I think it's a good general introduction on what crypto can do. If you have someone who needs a like high level intro, I think that's a good way to start. But yeah, it's on my Twitter profile.
Cool. And any other last words or last thoughts for our audience before we wrap up?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people are probably listening because they have an investing mindset. I think it's very easy to have an investing mindset and then check the prices every day and then kind of drift into a trading mindset. I've certainly felt that happen. I think generally speaking, if you're the big difference is an investing mindset is a zero sum mindset. Many people can win. Whereas a trading mindset, it's a zero sum mindset. Someone has to lose for you to win. One is easy, one is hard. Unless you're a specialist, I think people should stick to an investing mindset, buy for the long run, kind of examine your own psychology, keep a trading journal. And, you know, I think if you keep it that way, crypto has the potential to be like one of those generational investing themes that will make a huge difference. Like, you want to be the person who said, I own Amazon back in 98. Like, that to me is my dream. That's why I mean, kind of Ethereum so big right now. I think if you can create a system for yourself where you don't sell out and there will be 80% drawdowns over and over and over again, each of those are just traps to prevent you from kind of getting to the end point. Like, build a system where you can get to the end point, and I think you can be the person who says, yeah, I bought Amazon back in 98.
Yeah, definitely interesting thoughts. I resonate with you in terms of us being still at the top of the first inning, like regarding DeFi and this transformation that we'll see in terms of finance and the whole finance world. It's going to be an interesting next decade of major transformation and also opportunities, you know, lots of various, you know, things will change, companies will come up, new protocols, and just it'll be an amazing, I think, time. So I'm glad we're able to touch bases today. All right, James, thanks a lot. And we'll talk to you hopefully soon.
Thank you, Dave. Okay. Great show.
All right. Bye.